Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Back in 1961, President Kennedy declared to the United Nations that the weapons of war must be abolished before they abolish us. In 2010, there are 23,000 nuclear weapons at large in the world, in the possession of the U.S., Russia, Pakistan, China, and more. A new documentary says now is the time to disable our nukes before a terrorist or just a clumsy accident leads to the instant death of millions. This hour On Point, countdown to zero and the cause for disarmament. You can join the conversation. Is it time to disarm? Or are nuclear weapons still a necessary part of the arsenal? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Culver City, California, is Lucy Walker. She's a documentary filmmaker, director of the films Devil's Playground, about Amish teenagers coming of age, and Blindsight, about blind Tibetans climbing Everest. She's turned her lens to the global nuclear threat in the new documentary Countdown to Zero, which was made with the producer of An Inconvenient Truth. Lucy Walker, it's great to have you here. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So with so many other issues swirling domestically and internationally, what brought your attention to this topic now?
Oh, my goodness. Unfortunately, I think this may be the most important of all, but I do think we're sort of snoozing on it. I was a child in the Cold War, and I remember how scared we all were and how horrible the threat seemed. It really was this sort of Damocles that was sort of hanging over all of our heads. I know I grew up in Europe, in England, in fact, but I also know, you know, throughout Europe, throughout the North America, I think that we all felt tremendously afraid of what these weapons could do and sort of aware of the problem. And I knew that the problem hadn't gone away, the fear had, and I wanted to investigate that. And I had just had this question, what is going on with the world of nuclear weapons? What do we need to know? Because I feel sure that we need to be looking at it, but I'm not sure. It was sort of a sincere and innocent question. What's going on with weapons, terrorism, proliferation? Could terrorists ever get their hands on these things? Which countries have them and which countries might get them? What should we be worried about?
Well, you've assembled a nuclear who's who of scientists, writers, and politicians whom you interviewed for this documentary, and you structured it around President John F. Kennedy's 1961 address to the United Nations about disarmament.
Today, every inhabitant of this planet must contemplate the day when this planet may no longer be habitable. Every man, woman, and child lives under a nuclear sword of Damocles, hanging by the slenderest of threads, capable of being cut at any moment by accident or miscalculation or by madness. The weapons of war must be abolished before they abolish us.
Lucy Walker, why was that a defining speech, a defining moment?
Well, I think it crystallizes a lot of the concerns that are still here today. And I think, if anything, what's remarkable when you look at the history, and the movie really isn't a history lesson, it really focuses on the current situation, but it does backtrack just so that people, I think, get a really good, firm understanding of the whole of the issue. But what's remarkable when you look back in history is that Kennedy, in 1961, was really thinking exactly the same way that the leaders, I think, are thinking now in terms of the risk that we face. And even actually going back even further, the movie includes Oppenheimer, the father of the atomic bomb, who oversaw the project at Los Alamos, the Manhattan Project, mm-hmm. and in 1945, of course, that resulted in the first test in July 1945 and the bombings at Hiroshima and Nagasaki in August 1945, which is 65 years ago this week. And looking back, what's remarkable is that Oppenheimer understood the situation that we're facing in 2010 as well. And his comments seem so remarkably prescient. He talks about how he's concerned that the same technology that we used in Japan could be used against Americans, and that 40 million Americans could be killed in 20 of the largest towns overnight using this exact same technology, and that there's nothing to stop it being used against us. And actually, in a Senate hearing, that he was asked, well, how would you stop it? And how would you stop, say, for example, New York City being blown up? And he said, with a screwdriver to open up every single container that comes into the city, which is exactly what we're up against today. And at the leadership level, I feel like Kennedy in 1961, Reagan, interestingly, in 1986, and Obama in 2010, I feel like they're all singing the same song. And it's the exact same concerns. These weapons have the capacity to destroy us as human beings, to literally end life as we know it on the planet. And this sort of Damocles that we're living under is the most overwhelming threat.
Well, with 23,000 nuclear weapons at large in the world today, in the documentary Countdown to Zero, you interview nuclear terrorism expert Graham Allison, who talks about, in great detail, the ease of smuggling atomic bomb materials into the United States.
100 pounds of highly enriched uranium is smaller than a football. It would fit in a six-pack of beer cans. Every way that drugs come to New York City would be the same way you would imagine highly enriched uranium coming. If you have any doubt about the ability of Al-Qaeda to bring highly enriched uranium into the U.S., they could always hide it in a bale of marijuana.
Lucy Walker, tell us about some of these real-life nuclear smugglers whom you interviewed. One tried to sell weapons-grade bomb materials to a man he thought was Al-Qaeda. In fact, it was a sting operation. His name was Oleg Kanaskov.
Kintsugov.
Tell us his story.
Well, he's an interesting case because he was sort of a truck driver and sort of minor peddler and sort of sold sausages and was a car mechanic and sort of scrabbling around to support himself in the wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union. He's from North Ossetia in the Caucasus, and he right by the Georgian border, and he managed to get a hold of this bomb-grade, real-deal, weapons-grade, highly enriched uranium, and felt very motivated to participate in an attack on the United States. And I sat down with him in jail in Tbilisi, Georgia, which was quite a journalistic coup because no other journalist, even in a print journalist, had sat down, and I managed to get in there for a long interview with a film crew, which was fascinating and the most terrifying experience of my life, I must say, because for a few reasons. One was the level of ignorance. I mean, he talks about how the Taliban had been trained by U.S. agents in the Scottish Highlands, and it's very shocking when you picture a nuclear smuggler, you don't sort of realize quite how misinformed they might be. You know, you think someone who's going to destroy the world might have a reasonable, accurate understanding of how it works, and he couldn't have been more wrong, obviously, about the Scottish Highlands and the Taliban, or at least nobody else I've ever heard of has that theory. And more frightening still, he talked about how 9 grams can bring down the elephant, which he was talking about how a bullet can bring down an elephant, and how likewise a very small amount of nuclear weapons material could bring down as elephant-sized, as big a country as the U.S., and that he thought this was a good thing. And it was so chilling to sit there with somebody who'd actually really, in his own mind, participated in an attack on the U.S. He'd been selling to someone he thought was Al-Qaeda in sort of good faith and hope that this would result in an attack on the U.S. And to sort of sit there with him I had this funny feeling, gosh, if I'd sat down with Mohammed Atta before 9/11, this might have been how that interview would have gone. And it was just the most frightening thought imaginable. And I guess when I began the movie, I hadn't realized that all the steps it would require in order to bomb a U.S. city like New York City, which where I called home for very many years. All those steps not only could theoretically take place, but had in fact all individually taken place. Unfortunately, not in one connected sequence that had resulted in an attack, but individually they weren't theories or possibilities. They were actual, really plausible, possible events, and I found that so frightening.
How many groups or nations have access to nuclear material, given your research?
Well, we talk there's the nation states and the non-state actors. So nation states, we've got 9 nuclear weapon states now. We've got the US, Russia, China, UK, France, Israel, India, Pakistan, and North Korea. And the big question mark is Iran, which seems to be about to be the 10th on the list. And then the real question is that a tipping point? Many experts believe that that'll be the tipping point. And when Iran sort of goes nuclear, who is going to be next? Syria, Saudi Arabia, South Korea. There's certain other countries that really might be anxious to follow suit or seem to be headed, down that path also. So we're no longer looking at a world where a few countries, a sort of safe nuclear club with relatively secure arsenals, have them. We're looking at a world in which maybe 20 or more countries will have nuclear weapons, possibly quite soon. And we're also looking at a world in which it may not be very long before non-state actors or terrorist groups get a hold of nuclear weapons. And the film looks at that threat very seriously.
Well, we'll get to that after the break.
Yeah.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're discussing the new documentary Countdown to Zero and Nuclear Threat this hour. You can see the trailer of the film at our website, onpointradio.org. My guest today is Lucy Walker. She interviewed over 80 top nuclear experts and foreign dignitaries for her new documentary, Countdown to Zero. The hardest part of building an atomic bomb is getting the materials, highly enriched uranium, plutonium. In the documentary, Harvard professor Matthew Bunn talks about the fact that many countries have them and that they're often poorly guarded.
There was a case at a Russian naval base in the early 1990s. One of the naval personnel told a relative of his where the highly enriched uranium at this base was. This relative walked through a gaping hole in a security fence, walked up to what you and I would consider to be a tool shed, snapped the padlock with an iron bar. He set off no alarm. He was not detected at all. The Russian military prosecutor in that case said, quote, potatoes were guarded better.
Potatoes were guarded better, Lucy Walker. I mean, you tell stories in this documentary of poorly guarded nuclear materials that were exchanged for household appliances and fancy cars. I mean, mm-hmm. How could this be? Is it just underdeveloped countries that don't lock down their nuclear material?
Well, I think the security collapse in the wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union was very frightening, and they had such an incredibly, giant amount of this material.
Yes.
That a lot of these thefts have been traced back to there. But it's not just there, actually. I was also in South Africa in Palindaba. Their nuclear establishment had a frightening break-in where thieves really had access to this stuff. And South Africa, an interesting story, used to have nuclear weapons, and then they gave them up. And in a very nice story, they have turned their nuclear weapons into medical isotopes for cancer treatments, which is such a nice sort of beautiful mythic repurposing, isn't it? But the trouble that we're really up against with these things is they're not as crazy difficult to detect as you'd think, and they're quite portable. And they're not very radioactive. You can even pretty much handle the things, and they're very—it's very heavy, but it's very dense material. So it sits in a backpack, about the amount of material you'd need for a nuclear bomb, is sort of the size of a six-pack of beer or a couple of grapefruits, and it's not very radioactive. We look at port security in the movie, and we talk to the people who are scanning at ports, and we realize what they're up against, because even by itself it's not radioactive, and then you can very easily shield it, and then it's inside big containers, so you can't even get very close to it. And of course 100,000 of these shipping containers arrive in the US every single day, and you can't really go through each one of them with a microscope, or even sort of by hand. And the radioactive signature of nuclear material, this highly enriched uranium or plutonium, which have these very special property of being, of the thing that makes a nuclear bomb nuclear, being fissionable or fissile, that they sustain this chain reaction that means that even a small bomb could destroy a whole city, because the energy release would be so amazingly great. But before they go critical, by themselves they're sort of strangely easy to handle. It doesn't seem right, but you could stick them in a bucket and walk around and not keel over. And even kitty litter has a more detectable radioactive signature than this stuff. So a lot of things like granite toilets and kitty litter you can detect in ports, whereas you can't detect these small amounts of material that would actually make for a nuclear device. And the challenge there is that if you can get a hold of this material, the making of the bomb is not as hard as you'd think. So the actual construction of a bomb is sort of a graduate student level of problem. A few scientists with the sort of graduate student level could successfully design and build a bomb.
In fact, you tell the story in your documentary about a Senate hearing that was led by then-Senator Joe Biden, who didn't believe it, and scientists actually brought in a hastily assembled device into a classified hearing room to prove how easy it was to design and assemble something like that.
Well, exactly. And the only thing that's missing is this special ingredient, the nuclear material.
Right.
So that's why it's got to be locked up so carefully, and that's why the threat is so terrible that this material should be unsecured, because in the wrong hands, that the results would be so truly catastrophic.
According to U.S. intelligence, Osama bin Laden had a meeting with Pakistani nuclear scientists prior to the 9/11 attacks. And I want to play a clip from the documentary. Here's Graham Allison. He's an expert on nuclear terrorism on the al-Qaeda threat.
The objective of al-Qaeda is to, quote, kill 4 million Americans, including 2 million children. This is, in his calculation, what's required to balance the scales of justice. He takes various incidents from Shatila to the war in Iraq and counts up the body count and says, that's how many people we're owed, 4 million. You're not going to get to kill 4 million people by hijacking airplanes and crashing them into buildings.
How intent is al-Qaeda on either acquiring a bomb or building it themselves?
Unfortunately, it absolutely is. And I was nervous, but I just wouldn't do it. In terms of making empty threats, I guess, you know, we famously heard that we didn't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud, and that, you know, turned out to be not quite accurate. And so I felt very concerned not to just sort of say al-Qaeda, scary, and in fact to just find out sincerely what had all been going on with al-Qaeda and with terrorist groups. And I guess that the truth is very scary, which is that there were meetings, that there were efforts, there are documents and sincere and actual efforts, and not just by al-Qaeda. We also look at a group called Amishin Rikyo. They're the Japanese death terror cult that wound up becoming very famous after their sarin gas attack on the Tokyo subway. But the truth was that they were also pursuing getting a hold of uranium and enriching it, and had made very active and concrete steps, like buying uranium mines and stuff. And the we have in the movie someone called Rolf Moert Larsen, who is the head of WMD for the CIA, and is terrifically a brilliant person, and really puts the intelligence in intelligence. And he said that what was perhaps most frightening in his career was realizing that these terrorist groups were trying to get a hold of nuclear weapons and had actually taken these steps, and that they were even, you know, figuring out how to build a bomb, and therefore this fissile material that we have, it really couldn't be a higher premium on protecting it, because the terrorist groups had figured out that the making of the bomb would be easy if they could get a hold of this stuff.
Let's take a couple of calls, Lucy. First to Jackson, Tennessee. Matt is on the line. Hi, Matt. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I've got a question and a comment. My question is, I'm not really sure what your guest is wanting to happen with the nuclear weapons. Is she wanting America to basically debomb, or let's say dismantle all the bombs, and expecting Russia and China to do the same? And I just think even if we did it, I think it's very unrealistic that they would do it also. And my comment is, the state of Israel has, I've heard, up to 60 bombs, maybe a little fewer, maybe a little less. And I think if anybody needs protection, it's Israel. And I'm not in favor of using nuclear weapons whatsoever, but I think in Israel's case that it's probably the best deterrent that they have, considering that they're surrounded by hostile nations.
All right, Matt, thank you. Lucy Walker, what about disarmament?
It's an excellent question, but everyone should be reassured that no one's proposing that we just set these things down. That's not realistic. That's not helpful. Nobody's suggesting that. It's, much more kind of complicated than that. The good news is no one's suggesting it. The bad news is it's a little bit more complicated. And I think that old question of unilateral versus multilateral disarmament seems actually quite Cold War thinking. Sort of that's based on this idea that a few nuclear weapons countries had these relatively secure arsenals, and you could point them at each other in this deterrence pattern. In other words, you're never going to hit me because I'll hit you back if you do. And that model of Cold War, sort of US and Russia pointing these things at each other, which are still pointed at each other, by the way, that's sort of frightening in and of itself, as those things are still poised to go within a minute, and that scares me still. But no one's sort of suggesting that we should just stop having our weapons, because you're right that there is a sort of status quo and a security in the current situation. But the trouble is that moving forward, we're looking at a world where a lot of countries, and maybe terrorists too, are going to have nuclear weapons. And you get into a whole new world of problems, which is that if a terrorist threatens to hit you with a nuclear weapon, how do you threaten to hit them back? Because they have no return address. And also, it seems, may not even mind dying themselves. So we're the ones who don't want our population to be killed. But we can't really use nuclear weapons to discourage them from hitting us with nuclear weapons. And we're also in a world where in countries where there's nuclear weapons, what if they get into the wrong hands? One country that we look at in the movie is Pakistan. Now, Pakistan is a lot of the major things to worry about in the world as regards nuclear weapons. You can sort of point to Pakistan and really get worried, because they have a country that's pretty unstable. It's the world headquarters of Al-Qaeda. It's a country in which both the nuclear weapons establishment, people that work with the nuclear weapons, and also the army have extremist elements within them. And there's also the possibility of that army splitting or having what they call a colonel's coup. So you've got a very unstable situation there and a bunch of nuclear weapons. Now, I don't know about you guys, but if one of those nuclear weapons was to get into the wrong hands, one of these weapons could destroy a whole city. And that fear that we'd have, even if just one of these weapons got into the wrong hands, that it might be our city, would really be so game-changing in terms of, I mean, I personally would feel very uncomfortable living in a major U.S. city as I do. After that, I might take to the hills with some chickens, you know. I mean, it really is something to try and think about is if a terrorist group had one nuclear weapon, would you want to live where you're living right now? I know that it would change everything for me.
Well, you talk about the terrorist threat in the documentary, and of course that's the deliberate threat. But I have to say, some of the scariest parts of the documentary were the unintentional nuclear threats by accident or misjudgment or pure miscalculation. Here's one example. The mistakes can just happen, even with nuclear warheads. In 1961, over Goldsboro, North Carolina, a B-52 broke apart midair. Two nuclear bombs fell out. One bomb survived when the parachute deployed. On the other bomb, a parachute failed to deploy, and five of six safety devices malfunctioned. One switch prevented a nuclear explosion. Here's Scott Sagan. He's a political scientist from Stanford.
When I worked in the Pentagon, I believed that the likelihood of a nuclear weapons accident in the United States occurring was very low. I still believe that. But low probability events happen. They happen all the time.
How often, Lucy Walker?
Too often. I guess the BP oil well disaster is sort of a reminder as well of how hindsight's 2020, and these low probability accidents do occur, and then afterwards we can sit around and say, well, gosh, how did we let that happen? But in the case of a nuclear accident, you really want to be trying to think about it before and prevent it from happening, because the consequences would be so horrible. And yet, just because the consequences would be so horrible doesn't mean that it's less likely to happen. That's how it feels, right? It feels that it would be so unimaginably awful if a nuclear weapon were to actually go off by accident, that surely that means that the risk of it happening is zero. But we have Scott Sagan in the movie explaining how you can never get the risk down to zero.
Well, there's another actually dramatic example of that about nuclear near misses, specifically a moment in 1995 when the U.S. launched a four-stage rocket from Norway as part of a scientific experiment, and Russia thought that we had launched an attack against them. Tell us briefly what happened.
Well, according to the protocol, according to the steps laid out that Yeltsin should have followed, he should have launched a full-scale retaliation on the U.S. that day. And we don't know what happened, but we do know that he didn't, because we're still sitting here. They actually got this thing called the football, which is the briefcase, which has the sort of button in it. And he should have pressed it, and he hesitated, thank goodness. But really, the sort of script he should have been following provoked an all-out attack. And I think we have so many examples in the movie that are so jaw-dropping in terms of, malfunctioning computer chips and weather balloons and all these events. And the thing that scares me is that that was the U.S. and Soviet Union. That was, just two enemies pointed at each other. The future world, might be much more complicated. We might have a whole bunch of different enemies with different beef at different points in time over the years to come. And how often will our luck always hold? Will someone always, as Yeltsin did that day in 1995, hesitate and not follow the script and not press the button when all their advisors are expecting them to?
Some of the stories also sound incredible. The story in the 1970s about how the U.S. Strategic Command set the 12-digit code for the Minuteman nuclear missiles. You got to tell that story briefly, if you would.
That's right. Well, they didn't think there should be any security code at all. And they were so annoyed that it was actually Secretary Bob McNamara that forced them against their wishes, the Strategic Command, to install these security codes. And these security codes really meant that as somebody says in the movie, it wouldn't take General Jack D. Ripper, that's the character in Dr. Strangelove, to set off World War III. Any old lieutenant sitting in a silo could have done that prior to that. So Secretary McNamara saw that was a problem and wanted there to be security codes, but the Strategic Command so resented this that they installed them, but they set them to all zeros, so they wouldn't really be such a problem. And then they also put them in the checklist at the beginning of every shift. The missileers had to actually, regurgitate. They had to sort of check that everyone knew that it was all zeros, so there was no security protection there whatsoever. Mm.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking this hour about the nuclear threat today. And here's a montage from the documentary Countdown to Zero, describing what happens when an atomic bomb is dropped.
There were 76,000 buildings in Hiroshima. 70,000 of them were destroyed. The hospitals, the fire stations, the communication equipment, the military installations, everything just flattened.
The first 5 to 6 miles, virtually everyone in that 5 mile radius is going to die. Somewhere between 3 and 4 million people dead immediately in the first 5 miles.
Lucy Walker is with me this hour. She wrote and directed the documentary Countdown to Zero, and you can see the trailer at our website, onpointradio.org. I'd like to bring another voice into the conversation now. Joining me from Washington is Keir Lieber, associate professor at Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service. He's working on a book on nuclear deterrence during the Cold War and why preventing the use of nuclear weapons in the 21st century is likely to be more challenging than in the past. Keir Lieber, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Jane.
Why will it be more challenging than in the past?
Oh, well, there are all sorts of deterrent challenges that the United States is likely to face in the 21st century that are very different from the kinds of challenges we faced in the Cold War.
So what are the solutions that you propose to counter the nuclear threat and to get us further toward disarmament?
Well, actually, apropos of this discussion, I think it's worth saying that the threats that have been discussed, nuclear terrorism, accidents, miscalculation, all those things deserve lots of attention. One can debate the degree to which they're threats, but in general, they deserve attention. But demanding global zero as a solution to those threats, I think, is simply naive.
Naive because it just couldn't happen, given the world we live in today?
Yeah, it's unattainable. That's actually the good news. It's unattainable mainly because nuclear weapons are a useful tool of statecraft. They've been an essential part of U.S. strategy for over 60 years, and even if the U.S. came to the conclusion that they were no longer useful, other states would likely see things differently, and I think for good reasons. But again, that's the good news, is that it actually won't happen. The bad news is that a serious pursuit of global zero could well be detrimental to U.S. national security and international peace and stability.
Is there a responsible and sustainable way, then, to keep a nuclear arsenal?
Yes, in fact, there is. What U.S. policymakers, what the American public, what others need to think about is what kinds of forces are going to be useful for the deterrent threats we'll face in the years ahead. And again, one of the ironies is that pursuing the delegitimization of nuclear weapons, allowing the U.S. nuclear arsenal to wither on the vine, if we stop improving, testing, adapting our weapons, that will somehow be an important symbolic step towards nuclear disarmament. In fact, all it will be doing is undermining the appropriate capabilities for deterrence.
Lucy Walker, with America under the threat of terrorism, why should we unhand our nuclear advantage?
Because there's no bar to entry to the nuclear club anymore. Any state that has a college is going to be able to have a nuclear weapon, and pretty soon any non-state actor is going to be able to have a nuclear weapon. So we're no longer in that Cold War thinking, hey, we can have nukes because we don't want to be vulnerable to the rest of the world. Unfortunately, in future, there's only really a couple of options. One is a lot of countries and indeed non-state actors with nuclear weapons. And it's impossible, as we show in the film, to ever be really sure that something isn't going to go wrong, or a world in which people are really cooperating working towards or establishing a status quo in which nobody has them. And that once you have that prevailing thinking, it's actually much easier to protect against rogues, to work out deterrence strategies that involve cooperation, to really manage and secure that new paradigm. The trouble is that the alternative with a bunch of different countries and non-state actors with nuclear weapons is inevitably going to result in nuclear disaster. And I don't know how many nuclear disasters people are going to have before, you know, it may not happen, you know, that nuclear weapons are brought under control in time to prevent a catastrophe. But I certainly hope that they will, because my view is that one nuclear bomb going off will change people's thinking. But I think it would be better to change the thinking before the nuclear bomb goes off.
Your response, Keir Lieber?
Yeah, well, hope is not a policy. And I think demanding global zero as a solution to these threats leads people to take their eye off what are some more appropriate and pragmatic steps of securing materials, winning the war on terrorism, if that can be done in a reasonable way. The fact is, nuclear weapons are useful. They're useful for many countries. They were useful for the United States and the NATO allies in the Cold War when we faced the Soviet juggernaut. We relied on them quite a bit back then. So it's a bit odd for the United States and others today to claim that nuclear weapons aren't useful, especially given our conventional advantage in conventional military systems. We obviously prefer to fight our wars at the conventional level, but other states, like Matt from Tennessee pointed out, Israel, for example, have great use for nuclear weapons.
What about the current policy? Do you agree with it, Keir Lieber, that decades after the Cold War, that the U.S. and Russia still have these missiles on hair trigger trained at one another?
I agree that the focus on U.S.-Russia, that the New START Treaty, for example, does, is misleading. Nuclear weapons are not a relic of the Cold War. The U.S.-Russian strategic balance may well be. But the fact of the matter is, the United States, the primary deterrent challenge the United States is facing is not Russia. It's going to be controlling nuclear escalation in a possible future conventional conflict against a smaller armed nuclear power.
Let's get a caller in here. Philip is in Montreal. Hi, Philip. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Hi, Lucy.
Hi. Go ahead.
I think that the concept of nuclear disarmament, although completely laudable, I think it's probably an unrealistic fantasy. I have to wonder, to begin with, how reliable really is the inventory of nuclear warheads out there? Why would the 9 or 10 countries have divulged the actual numbers of warheads and equipment that they have? How do we know that terrorist groups don't already have nuclear capability?
Philip, thank you. Lucy Walker?
Well, there is actually a whole technology and science and a whole establishment of amazing thinkers, policy people, and scientists who've been really cracking their head against this problem. And the good news is there is some really – that's an excellent question and some really reassuring answers, which is that these things do take a big establishment to support and sustain. They're sort of chemical, so if you don't sort of keep them maintained, they don't work anymore. And you do squadrons of brilliant people, and I was embedded with the IAEA and various amazing organizations that really have tremendous scientific capability in terms of detecting and controlling arsenals and understanding exactly who's got what. But that's much easier to do when there's a whole regime of transparency and communication and cooperation, and there are only a certain amount of these materials in the world that can be that have distinct signatures that can be traced.
Keir Lieber, I'll let you jump in here.
Yeah, I'll simply just return to the point that all the talk about how horrible nuclear weapons are runs the risk of convincing us that our allies and we shouldn't maintain these weapons to keep the peace. You know, at the end of the day, when you look back at human history, there are two distinct periods, the period pre-1945 and after 1945. And then just the first half of the 20th century, in that first period when the strong did what they wanted and the weak suffered what they must, 100 million people died in conventional conflict, just in the first half of the 20th century. And after 1945, when the weak could keep the powerful at bay with nuclear weapons, when the strong could deter the strong with nuclear weapons, there's been no real war among nuclear-armed states. And there's a good reason why, because nuclear weapons induce great caution even during crises.
Here's Wayne in Sherbourne, Massachusetts. Lucy, hold on. Let's get a listener in here. Go ahead, Wayne. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi,
I saw the Countdown to Zero on Sunday, and I thought it did an excellent job of laying out the dangers of nuclear weapons and making the case for the long-term goal of eliminating them, which will take a long time and a lot of political change. But what needed now is practical first steps. And the very first step is the ratification of the new Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty that's been negotiated by Russia and the United States and signed by President Obama and President Medvedev in April. It's going to be considered perhaps as early as this week in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and perhaps this fall. It's a modest next step that would bring down the number of deployed warheads on each side to about 1,500. And it continues the process that was started by Presidents Reagan and George H.W. Bush. And it's being held up by the Republicans who want as a price for it a commitment to spend another $100 billion or perhaps even $170 billion over the next 10 years to rebuild four facilities in Savannah River, in Oak Ridge, in Los Alamos, and a new private facility in Kansas City that would give us the capacity of building perhaps 400 new nuclear warheads. And that undercuts the treaty and the progress towards disarmament and sends the wrong message to the rest of the world.
Wayne, thank you for the call. It actually brings me to the point of this new generation of leadership, this treaty that was signed. What about that? Do we have a new generation of leaders, and how will that affect this issue to your mind, Lucy Walker?
Well, I do think that it's exciting that the president has called for a world without nuclear weapons, and he has said it might not happen in our lifetime, but that the signing this, ratifying the START Treaty is absolutely the best next step. But it is interesting. It's not just me. I'm a documentary filmmaker, but I interviewed all these heads of state, and they all said zero is the only stable, safe number of nuclear weapons in the world. And the history is amazing with President Reagan, for example, that great liberal. He proposed all-out disarmament to President Gorbachev in 1986 in Reykjavik. And I interviewed, unfortunately, of course, I couldn't interview President Reagan. He was probably top of the list of people I would have loved to have interviewed for the movie. But of course, unfortunately, we can't. But President Gorbachev, I was able to interview. And he spoke very candidly in the movie to me in our interview about how much regret he had that he wasn't able with President Reagan to do more to secure our world from the nuclear threat. And this was his great regret. And all these heads of state calling for zero nuclear weapons, it isn't the naive situation anymore. Over two-thirds of the living defense secretaries and secretaries of state on both sides of the aisle, Republicans, Democrats, all agree that this is the best next step and this is the goal that we need to be working towards.
Keir Lieber.
The United States and all of the major great powers signed on to the Non-Proliferation Treaty when, as part of that deal, they committed themselves to disarming. It's been U.S. policy from virtually the beginning, and yet the United States, just like Russia, just like China, has no intention whatsoever of ridding the world of nuclear weapons. It's a rhetorical strategy. Again, I worry that we go from rhetoric to actual policy that would undermine the role of nuclear weapons in our national security strategy.
Here's another call from Gary in Burlington, Vermont. Hi, Gary. Welcome to the program. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, I'm amazed, Jane, you've made a perfect reason for what Einstein said right at the beginning, that you can't give these weapons to competitive nation states, that this is an absolute weapon, and anybody who considers using it is what the International Criminal Court would call an enemy of humanity. And my question is very simple. I was a bomber pilot in World War II. I'm a veteran of World War II, mm-hmm. Flew B-17s and was on the Peenemünde raid, which wiped out Hitler's heavy water plant. And I decided that in order to make world peace, we had to have a world government. That's what Einstein said. That's what everybody was saying from 1945 to 1950, including Emory Reeves at the Anatomy of Peace. So these nine men who have their finger on the nuclear button, these nine heads of state, according to the statute of the International Criminal Court, in my view, these are enemies of humanity because the nuclear weapon cannot be used. They're pointing the gun, as you yourself pointed out. This is a sword of Damocles pointed at humanity.
Yeah.
Well, the only structure which would be advisable or able to structure the elimination of nuclear weapons is obviously what Einstein pointed out, a world government. What is your reply, please?
Gary, thank you. Keir Lieber.
Yeah, Jane, I think the only thing even less likely than global zero is a world government. I just point out all this talk about the sword of Damocles, the fear of nuclear holocaust during the Cold War. Surely that's better than the sword actually being used, actually slashing and slaughtering people. And I don't think Kerry would have had to serve at all in a war if Poland, for example, had had nuclear weapons in 1939, or if France had had nuclear weapons in 1940. Or the Soviet Union in 1941. The whole point of nuclear weapons is that they are an incredible deterrent. They deter aggression if they are secure and if they're not vulnerable to a first strike. And we've been living in an era of the nuclear peace for a long time that we've sort of lost sight of that basic fact of the nuclear world.
Here's Mike in Olean, New York. Hi, Mike. Welcome to On Point.
Hi. Great show, important show. One quick point, and I'm running out of time. Nuclear weapons is not an entity that one could get rid of. It is knowledge. It is science. If all the nations of the world who have nuclear weaponry get rid of them tomorrow, the science behind it, the knowledge and information that could create it still exists. And that is always going to be a danger. And for that, we always need a deterrent. I'll take the response off the air.
Mike, thank you. Lucy Walker, I'll give you the last word on that.
I do agree the science is there, but if the if there is a prevailing non-proliferation regime that is stable, I think that's going to be way easier to maintain. And it really is. It's this new thinking. It's just we've got to get rid of this Cold War thinking that these things are deterring us and keeping us safe. You know, that did work. It's worked for 65 years. The problem is in future, it's not going to work. And when it doesn't work, the consequences are going to be so horrible. These weapons, it's so counterintuitive that these weapons, powerful as they are and appealing as it is to have the world's most powerful weapons, in future we can't use them. They're only going to be used against us. And it is in the US's interest really get interested in how the thinking has to change and what is the new paradigm that's way safer. And all these heads of state, all these nuclear weapons scientists, all these experts, they all told me that the only way forward is global zero. Now, it's not naive because it's a whole long and very sophisticated strategy in terms of getting there. But this old thinking that these deterrents worked, you know what? Maybe it did. It got us this far. I totally agree.
Well, Lucy Walker,
in the future, we really need a different thinking.
I appreciate your time. The new documentary film is Countdown to Zero. Thank you very much. And Keir Lieber, Associate Professor at Georgetown University. I appreciate your opposing view, Keir. Thank you. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.